go ahead and get started. I'm Shannon Hayden with the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project, and on behalf of our co-directors, Ruth Barton and Karen Von Hippel, who's right here in the audience. Can you guys hear me okay? Is this on? All right, well, anyway. We'd like to welcome you to the second in our series on poorly understood religious leaders. This series comes out of the findings from our Mixed Blessings Report, which was issued last year and is available online. We had Nadia Bilbasi Charters and Patrick Coburn in a few weeks ago to talk about Muqtada al-Sadr, and today we're welcoming Kareem Sajjadpour from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Sally Quinn from the Washington Post to talk about the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. We're going to have about a 30-minute conversation and then open it up for Q&A from the audience. So, Sally and Kareem.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Sally Quinn from the Washington Post. I'm co-moderator along with Newsweek editor John Meacham of On Faith, which is a religious blog on the Washington Post Newsweek.com. And I'm really very happy to be here this morning to talk to Kareem Sajjadpour, and I'm sure he probably doesn't need much introduction, but I will tell you that he is an associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he joined Carnegie 4 years ago as the chief Iran analyst at the International Crisis Group, based in Tehran and Washington. And he has written this amazing report, Reading Khamenei, the World's View of Iran's Most Powerful Leader. And I have to say, I really learned a lot from it. One of the great tidbits in the book, and it seems to me, and we'll get into this, Kareem, in a minute, there's a lot of paranoia here. But he quotes somebody as saying, you know, the way they're going to destroy us is, he says, they're not going to send bombs, they're going to send miniskirts. So I think, actually, this couldn't be more timely because of the news on Iran and the fact that Iran has tested out 9 missiles yesterday. And I thought it was particularly prescient. I got this quote from your report, where you are talking about Khamenei, and you say that, and you quoted him, according to Khamenei, this is a concerted strategy, the United States strategy, approach to nuclear issue, they've been more defiant than ever before. You say, this is a concerted strategy. He says, rights cannot be achieved by entreating. If you supplicate, withdraw, and show flexibility, arrogant powers will make their threat more serious, will take their threat more serious. So why don't you, we'll sort of back end, I mean, we were going to do it another way by talking about Khamenei, but I think we ought to start out with what's happening today and what this all means. What is this about, this whole testing out of missiles?
Sure. Well, first, thank you all very much for coming, and thank you for inviting me out. I was expecting like 10 people, so I'm very happy to see all of you here, and I'm very grateful for Sally. For moderating as well, and you know, just if we look at the more macro issue of U.S.-Iran relations to begin with, over the course of the last 2 weeks, I think we see a real representation of the worldview of Ayatollah Khamenei. Because last week, all of the news media were calling me to talk about Iran's conciliatory gestures, and you know, Iran is suddenly going to accept this nuclear deal. They're ready to talk to the Europeans. And this week, again, it's back to talk of, you know, World War III and Iran launching these missiles. And everybody says, you know, what's going on in Tehran? Are these, you know, conflicting signals? There's a joust for power, et cetera. And, you know, my take on it is that the joust in some ways is inside Ayatollah Khamenei's head. Whereas 10 years ago, there was kind of this, there was this joust taking place amongst conservatives and reformists in Iran, I think now Ayatollah Khamenei is very much consolidated power. It's not a dictatorship, but he's certainly more powerful than he's ever been in his 19-year tenure as leader. And I think his basic worldview has always been that never, when the West, particularly you know the United States or the Israelis, are trying to pressure you, you should never show that pressure is going to moderate your behavior. You should never compromise as a result of pressure, because if you compromise, it projects weakness and is going to invite even more pressure. So I think we've seen this, you know, we saw this now, but we also saw this last year If you recall, there were some Iranian Revolutionary Guardsmen. Iran claims they were diplomats who were taken by U.S. forces in Erbil, in Iraq. And what was the Iranian reaction? It wasn't to say, you know, sorry, let's compromise. The Iranian reaction was to take British sailors in captivity. They said, you know, you want to escalate, we have the means to reciprocate. So this is very much in Ayatollah Khamenei's worldview, that you never compromise as a result of pressure, because it projects weakness and it's going to invite even more pressure.
Well, but what about, what's the timing? What's the meaning of the timing of this?
Of this missile launch.
Missile launch.
Well, I mean, the last week or so, what have we seen? There was a report from Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker, which got a lot of press, about covert American operations in Iran. There was news of Israeli, essentially war games taking place, which the Israelis gave to The New York Times. You had Iran's largest bank, state-owned bank, Bank Melli, whose assets were frozen in Europe. So, you know, there was this series of moves that Iran interpreted as escalatory on the part of the West. And I think that the timing is simply that, to say that, when you guys want to escalate, we have the means to reciprocate. Now, there's something else I would also say, and this is just my own kind of cynical suspicions these days, but there was an extremely kind of gratuitously provocative statement from a few Revolutionary Guardsmen a day or so before these missiles were tested, saying, you know, we're going to offer a crushing blow to the United States. And yeah, I'm beginning to think that these guys are trying to manipulate oil prices as well, because they make these very blusterous statements, and oil goes up $2-3 a barrel. This is the equivalent of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of additional oil revenue for Iran. And, you know, oftentimes when they like to be provocative, then, you know, President Bush will say all options are on the table, and these oil traders go crazy. Oil goes up $10 a barrel. I mean, this is literally hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, additional oil revenue for Iran.
So if you were the Bush administration, I mean, one of the things that we obviously know is that this controversy that's going on inside the Bush administration about how we deal with Iran. I mean, do we impose sanctions? Do we threaten? Do we rattle swords? Do we talk about whether we're going to invade and we're going to bomb nuclear plants? And you hear that Cheney is for, you know, force, and Bob Gates is against it, and the Joint Chiefs are against it. But this continuing dialogue and the sort of and the perception that the United States might possibly do this. And I just came back from Europe, and I was at a conference there, and everyone there was sort of saying, is the United States going to bomb Iran? I mean, that clearly is a perception of a possibility. Do you think that this perception is one that the Iranians believe is a possibility?
It's a good question. And, you know, first of all, I would preface my response by saying I think it's unequivocally a bad idea. It would be quite disastrous, any type of U.S. military action. And my primary concern is actually not necessarily the regional repercussions, that Iran would react by launching Hezbollah missiles into Israel or further inflaming the situation in Iraq. You know, all of these things are potential. But for me, the even greater concern is what it would do domestically within Iran. And you have kind of this last oasis of goodwill which exists vis-a-vis the United States amongst the Iranian people. You know, in 2002, I used to say Iran is the most pro-American population in the Middle East. Now I say it's the least anti-American population in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, there's a real, a genuine goodwill towards the United States. And I think if U.S. bombs were to drop on Iran, it would entrench the most radical elements within Iran. And it would veer the population in a direction which I think is certainly not constructive for its long-term future. But I think within Tehran, if we try to get inside first the head of the president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, he's been saying for a long time now that the United States will never do it. And, you know, his kind of rudimentary reading of American politics is that in 2006, when the Democrats, the midterm elections, when the Democrats were elected back, this was representative of the fact that the U.S. population no longer has the appetite to embark on any type of kind of foreign policy adventurism in the Middle East. So he believes that essentially the hands of American politicians are tied. And quite frankly, this sounds kind of like a trite, throwaway comment, but I truly believe that military action is more of a carrot than a stick for President Ahmadinejad. Meaning, it's truly, I think, one of the things that could really rehabilitate his presidency if U.S. bombs were to drop on Iran. Because it will allow them a pretext to truly clamp down. It would allow him a pretext, would allow him an excuse for the economic failings of the country. But if we go back to Khamenei, Ayatollah Khamenei, he was president during the time of the Iran-Iraq war. He was a war president. He wasn't the supreme leader then. Ayatollah Khomeini was supreme leader, but still he experienced on a daily basis kind of the travails and the difficulties of governing a country when it's at war. So I think he has no interest in having another confrontation. But his worldview is this balance, you know, neither confrontation nor accommodation with the West. So I think that it kind of reminds me of, you know, when I was a kid and I would fight with my older brother, I kind of always knew which buttons to press, and stopping short of getting beaten up by him. I could kind of press the right buttons, and I think this is the belief that Iranian leaders have, that, you know, we push the buttons, but, you know, we won't push the button so hard that it's going to warrant kind of a massive retaliation from the United States.
Well, you mentioned Ahmadinejad in not believing the United States would attack. And you think that Khamenei has the same view of that he doesn't believe that we will, or do you think that they share the view?
You know, I think Khamenei is much more cautious. But again, I think when Khamenei wakes up in the morning, U.S. military strikes on Iran are perhaps less of a concern for him than some type of what he calls soft revolution. You know, he's much more concerned about the prospect of, he believes that, you know, the U.S. Goals vis-a-vis Iran are not to do an Iraq-style operation, or even to bomb the nuclear sites necessarily. But the U.S. has in mind kind of the model which they took in Eastern Europe, you know, Velvet Revolution, Soft Revolution, or the Soviet Union. So he's much more focused on these things. And, you know, again, they recognize that Iran's leverage vis-a-vis the United States is greater than it's ever been in the 28, 29-year history of the revolution, given the tremendous leverage Iran has in Iraq, and Lebanon, and Palestine, given the high prices of oil. So at the moment, they feel quite well-placed.
You talk about the relationship between Ahmadinejad and Khamenei, and clearly things are not going well economically, and Ahmadinejad's popularity has gone, sort of plummeted, and that's sort of a two-way street for Khamenei. In a way, it makes him more powerful, so that there would be a reason to keep Ahmadinejad in his role because he makes Khamenei look good.
Yeah.
On the other hand, some of the statements he makes, like the Holocaust never happened, make him seem so over the top and so unreasonable that it's almost impossible to have a dialogue with him. How do you think that Khamenei really feels about him?
I think that's, you know, it's such an important question now, the relationship between these two men, between Ayatollah Khamenei and President Ahmadinejad. And, you know, your points are correct, that I think on one hand you could argue that in some ways President Ahmadinejad is the ideal president for someone like Khamenei. First, he's to his right politically. So, you know, vis-a-vis Ahmadinejad, Khamenei looks like the new voice of reason, the new Khatami in Iran. Again, he's much more moderate than Ahmadinejad. And I think Khamenei likes to have a lame duck president who's really alienated the political elite in Iran. He was much more weary of a president like Mohammad Khatami, the previous president, the reform-minded president who has this overwhelming mandate. You know, 80% of Iranians voted for him, and his calls for dialogue of civilizations and democracy and political reform. This is much more unsettling for Khamenei than kind of a loyal lieutenant to the revolution like Ahmadinejad, who's going to continue to talk about the ideals of the revolution. But I do think, you know, in the last several months especially, that I imagine Khamenei is beginning to wonder, you know, is this guy, his costs are outweighing his benefits. Not only is he getting our skirts on fire internationally, you know, we have three UN Security Council resolutions. Our state banks are being frozen by the Europeans. There's constant, you know, Israeli and U.S. War games. But also domestically, I mean, this is the, you could argue this is the one population in the world who, you know, the one major oil-producing country in the world whose population claims that their economic lot has actually gotten worse over the last three, 4 years. I mean, this is, when you think about it, it's a remarkable achievement by President Ahmadinejad that, you know, oil prices have tripled, and all Iranians complain that their economic lot has actually gotten worse. So I think it will likely be a 25th-hour decision. The next presidential elections in Iran are around June of 2009. I'm sure he will see how the U.S. presidential elections go. And we're not talking about a free and fair election in Iran. I think it's not totally rigged, but I think Ayatollah Khamenei can really engineer who the candidates will be and who possibly gets, you know, the most votes. And I don't think he's going to make this decision about Ahmadinejad's future until, say, you know, next spring. But one thing I would say is that, you know, there has been some talk that Ahmadinejad is trying to usurp power from Khamenei, and he actually has ambitions to on behalf of the Revolutionary Guards, to take power away from the clerics, etc. When you talk to people, kind of the regime insiders in Tehran, they say that, you know, the dynamic between these two men is very clear. President Ahmed, even when you watch the body language, when you see pictures of them, Ahmadinejad prostrates himself in front of Khamenei. He's the only president who actually kisses Khamenei's hands in public. So, you know, it's very much kind of a master-pupil relationship.
Well, do you think that if Ahmadinejad knows that he is maybe overstepping the line and that he is losing favor, that he might cool it with some of the rhetoric?
He might, but, you know, this group of individuals, Ahmadinejad's team in Iran, having kind of seen and interacted with them up close, they're truly incorrigible. They're not individuals who sit back and reflect and say, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't have denied the Holocaust, or, you know, maybe Israel shouldn't be wiped off the map. Maybe we should reconsider Israel's right to exist. I mean, there are individuals who have, you know, kind of a mentality and a worldview that they're very much convinced of their righteousness. And, you know, I don't see him being that versatile a politician or that versatile kind of a thinker. And it's going to be very difficult for him to undo all of the alienation among the political elite in Iran. So, you know, I think that it's going to be very difficult, I should say, for Ahmadinejad to reinvent himself.
You've mentioned several times oil. Oil obviously plays a big role, not only for them economically, but for us. And I can't imagine that we would take any political and military decision without considering oil. Tell me what role oil plays in this. You talk about how you would think that they would be prospering because of the situation with oil. And I can't imagine that Khamenei is not interested in the economics of his country. And yet alienating so many people around the globe doesn't seem to be the way to economic prosperity.
Yeah, I mean, oil is really the lifeblood of this Iranian economy. I think 80% of their export revenue is derived from oil. And the oil industry is in a precarious, a tenuous position. Because what's happening is this. You know, Iran has, I think, the world's second largest reserves of oil. But their energy, their oil facilities, really haven't been developed or refined since the early days of the revolution. It suffered tremendous damage, their oil rigs and refineries, during the time of the Iran-Iraq War. And so they, by their own account, they require huge amounts of foreign direct investment to kind of refurbish and repair these facilities. And I think the number that the oil minister came up with a few years ago is they required about $100 billion reinvestment into their energy infrastructure just to retain their current output, which is about 4.2 million barrels per day. Now, and they estimated of that $100 billion, about, you know, two-thirds of it or half of it needed to come in foreign direct investment. Since Ahmadinejad has become president in 2005, it's quite obvious that he's is not coveted foreign investment, is repelled foreign investment. And so what's taking place is that their oil output is decreasing because, you know, their facilities are deteriorating over time. So their output is decreasing. It's not dramatic, but it's not insignificant either. I think 100, 200,000 barrels per day, it's decreasing. But simultaneous to that, their consumption, their domestic consumption, is increasing because, you know, this is a population which has doubled over the course of the last 25, 26 years. And this is a country that's churning out automobiles. And it's still cheaper in Tehran to buy a liter of water than it is a liter of gasoline. So, you know, there's not really much incentive to conserve if gasoline is so terribly cheap. So you have this graph.
Did you mean the other way around?
Yeah, it's cheaper to buy a liter of gasoline than water.
Right.
I'm sorry. Yeah. And so, you know, you have this graph that output is decreasing, and simultaneously that domestic consumption is increasing. So you could be in a scenario where, you know, 10, 12, 15 years from now, Iran could actually be a net importer of oil. And this is, you know, this is hugely significant, as I said, given that 80% of their export revenue derives from oil. So I think in the coming years, one of two things has to change. Either A, they will have to change their approach to domestic politics, and they will have to stop subsidizing oil and gasoline. It's going to be very difficult for this regime to do, because this is one of their mantras of, you know, kind of subsidizing products, caring for the poor, things like this. And especially for Ahmadinejad's government, his mantra was putting the oil money on people's dinner tables, so it's going to be very difficult for him to stop the subsidies. Or they will essentially have to change their approach to foreign policy. And instead of repelling foreign investment, they're going to have to project kind of a conciliatory face to the world to covet foreign investment. But rest assured, one of these two things is going to happen. You know, Thomas Friedman said this, that you know, if oil is at $20 a barrel, the Holocaust is no longer a myth. Meaning, you know, when it's not a coincidence that Iran's president first called for a dialogue of civilizations, Mohammad Khatami, oil was at $12 a barrel, and when Ahmadinejad first called for Israel to be wiped off the map, oil was at $70 a barrel. You know, it's not coincidental, the link between price of oil and Iranian foreign policy.
But from an economic standpoint, this just doesn't make any sense. It also, they seem to be putting an enormous amount of resources into weapons that they could be putting into infrastructure, into, you know, rebuilding the oil refineries and all of that. Why are they making this choice?
I mean, this regime is never, their priority has never been the economic well-being of the Iranian people. And you know, this sounds, I think even if you had an official from the Islamic Republic sitting in this room, they probably would agree with that statement. Let me give you kind of another example, going off on a tangent, but I think it's a relevant point. A few years back, actually it was last year, I was having a conversation with a senior Iranian official at one of these track 2 meetings in Europe, and I relayed to him a message which a Shiite Lebanese friend of mine once asked me. He said, think of all the money Iran has spent over the years on Hezbollah, right? Since Hezbollah's inception in 1982 to now, it spent upwards of, say, $1 billion or $2 billion on Hezbollah, arming Hezbollah, etc. And think of how many Lebanese Shiites Iran could have educated instead to become doctors and lawyers and engineers. And, you know, likewise the Palestinians. Instead of having armed Hamas and Islamic Jihad over the years, think of how many Palestinians Iran could have educated to become doctors and lawyers and engineers, and how much better off would that community have been. So I, you know, asked him this question. And he looked at me and said very frankly, you know, no, what good would that have done Iran? And I said, what do you mean? He said, do you think if we sent these guys to become doctors and lawyers and engineers, they're going to come back to South Lebanon and Gaza and fight Israel? No, they're going to be doctors and lawyers and engineers. So, I mean, it kind of crystallized for me that moment that Iran's approach, both domestically and kind of on a regional level, is a very cynical approach in which they're cognizant of the fact that they can be the champions of the downtrodden and the dispossessed, but they can't be the champions of the upwardly mobile, right? So, I mean, I lived in Beirut, and I can tell you my Shiite doctor and engineer friends were not fans of Hezbollah, and they were not fans of Iran. But the Shiite shopkeeper and taxi driver was a fan of Iran. And I think, you know, again, I think their approach to regional politics is such, and to an extent their approach to domestic politics is such, that, you know, the more upwardly mobile Iranians are, and the better off Iranians are, you know, the more probably they're going to agitate for political reform. This was one of the lessons of the 1979 revolution in Iran. It wasn't because, you know, people's economic prospects had worsened. Actually, people's economic prospects had suddenly improved during the time of the Shah, because there was this huge you know, increase in oil prices. And then suddenly, you know, oil prices contracted and there were some difficulties. But I think, you know, in some ways this regime is cognizant of their own strengths and weaknesses. And again, they know that they can be the heroes to the downtrodden, but they can't be the heroes to the upwardly mobile.
Well, this brings us to the question of religion and how strong a role religion plays. Now, obviously, the whole idea of Islam is charity and caring for the downtrodden and all of that, but part of that would be lifting people up into another and higher level, which is, seems to be the opposite of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So it seems contradictory in a way, their view of religion and what role it should play in their politics. Well, talk to me a little bit about how religion plays a role in politics and whether it's a good or a bad thing.
Sure, that's a great question. And you know, I was there was a passage from what I did basically when I wrote this was I read all of Khamenei's major and minor speeches over the course of, say, three decades. It was like 1,500 pages of material, and I tell people it was the antithesis of chicken soup for the soul, reading Khamenei. It's so kind of cynical and sinister, and it was a dark period in my life. But there was, you know, of all these things that I read, there was one thing that really jumped out at me. And Khamenei was giving a lecture to a group of visiting clergymen, I think from Austria, Christian priests. And he was kind of castigating them that, you know, why aren't young people in Europe going to church anymore? You know, the church-going percentages are like 2%, even in a country like Italy. And he was kind of chastising them and giving them a lecture of how you draw young people back to religion. And let me just kind of read this excerpt for you. And he says to them, youngsters have a natural inclination for religion and spirituality, but we should also try to create more attractions for them. And then he says, I believe that if religion defends the oppressed and advocates justice, it will become more attractive to youngsters, since youth everywhere in the world support movements that are aimed at administering justice. In fact, justice is part of all religions, and the most prominent heroes in the history of mankind who made strenuous efforts to administer justice were religious personalities. Your prophet Jesus struggled for justice during his entire life, and our prophet also spent his whole life trying to administer justice. If Christian and Muslim clergymen raise the issue of justice today, this will certainly create attraction. And I was thinking to the time when I was in college, and there were three posters hanging in my dorm room wall. One was Che Guevara, one was Muhammad Ali, and the third was Bob Marley. And, you know, how it's so true that, you know, in this Che Guevara t-shirt is, I think, the most popular icon and most popular selling image in the world. And it's so true that whatever country you're in, young people, of course, don't say, you know, there should be a great income disparity and, you know, the wealthy should stay wealthy and the poor should stay poor. No, there's this great thirst for this issue of justice. And I think what the Islamists have been able to do very effectively is to essentially link these two issues together, religiosity, and in particular Islamic religiosity, and this issue of justice. And I know your last discussion was about Muqtada Sadr. And Muqtada Sadr is not I don't see him at all a religious figure. I mean, he wears a turban, but you know, when it comes to learning and Shiism, theological qualifications in Shiism, he has the equivalent of a GED. I mean, he's not someone who's very well regarded, but you see the tremendous following he has, or Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah. I mean, there's these interesting polls which are often taken in the Arab world, in which Arab people are asked, which leaders in your region do you most admire? And invariably, Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah finishes first, who, again, I don't consider, you know, I don't see as a religious leader, as a political leader. Ahmadinejad second, and Khalid Mishal of Hamas third. And I think one reason is because they've done this more effectively than anyone, is to kind of project this image that what they're representing is justice. Islam represents justice, and they're one in the same. And I think what I find interesting about all of this is that, you know, Khamenei constantly says that if there were to be a referendum in any country in the Middle East, people, one person, one vote, let the chips fall where they may, if there were to be a referendum, it would produce political systems across the region which would look much more like Iran than the United States. So ironically, I think Khamenei believes that the best vehicle for Iran to assert its interests throughout the region is what? Is democratic elections. Because when democratic elections happen, Hamas gets elected in Palestine, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, Iran's Shiite co-religionists in Iraq. And I think the irony is that the only country in the region which probably that's not true is Iran. Iran is the only country in which there were to be, you know, one person, one vote democratic election. It wouldn't turn out the way it is now, simply because when people have been experienced, have experienced kind of this overdose of Islamist justice and this malaise the last three decades, I think they no longer romanticize about it.
But do you think that the young people in Iran are buying the whole notion that essentially keeping people down is justice?
No, I don't think the Iranians buy it at all, the Iranian population. Mm-hmm. But this goes into kind of the internal dynamics in Iran. But
you mentioned, I think, that there were, it's like two-thirds of the people in the country are now under 30.
Yeah, about two-thirds under 33. And, you know, there's this there was this adage which I love. A friend of mine, an Iranian sociologist, once said, he said, before the revolution, we used to drink outside, or people used to drink outside and pray inside the home. That after the revolution, people pray outside the home and drink inside. So you know, in some ways, I think this Islamic revolution has secularized the Iranian population more than. You know, I would say that I would make the argument it's the most secular middle class in the entire Middle East, and certainly they don't buy this notion that these clerics in Iran represent justice. On the contrary. These clerics are notorious for having very deep pockets, and you know, there's always. I think even Iranians, you know, my father's family, for example, comes from kind of traditional religious middle classes. You know, even those classes are extremely dubious about the genuine piety and goodwill of these clerics. But you know, so it goes to the question of how does this regime then survive? Where do they derive their legitimacy? And, you know, I was doing, I think, a Senate testimony once, and a senator asked me, is this regime legitimate? Do they have legitimacy? And I said, for me, the definition of legitimacy is monopoly of coercion. Basically, they have a monopoly of force. They don't derive a strong central state. They have, you know, a very strong army. And you know, they rule the country. It's not kind of a brutal dictatorship, but basically the population is their mentality is very Machiavellian, especially the mentality of the Ahmadinejad administration, in the sense that I think they would rather be feared than liked by their population. Now, these are the calculations.
What about Israel? How much does their antipathy toward Israel, obviously Ahmadinejad and Khamenei have different views of Israel, but how much of their antipathy toward Israel is about religion, and how much is it about politics?
That's a very good question. And this, by the way, was the thing that really surprised me the most about reading Khomeini, that over the course of 3 decades, the issue which featured most prominently in his talks and his rhetoric over the years is the issue of Israel, Palestine. And it's really quite remarkable when you think about it, because there's no land or border disputes between Iran and Israel. Iran is not Arab. It's in fact, you know, those of you familiar with Iran, Persians can be quite chauvinistic towards Arabs. There's no Palestinian refugee problem in Iran. Iran still has the largest Jewish community in the Middle East outside of Israel. So there's no particular reason why Iran should have this very deep-seated enmity toward Israel. And it doesn't, the question of Palestine and Israel doesn't resonate on the Iranian street as it does, you know, on the streets of Damascus and Cairo and Beirut. You know, a professor of mine from graduate school used to say that, I don't think you wake up in the morning in Shiraz and say, I wonder what's happening in Gaza. It's not you know, something that you're thinking about your daily bread and butter. But, you know, how people oftentimes explain it to me is that these guys, the older generation, especially in Iran, the older generation of clerics who were revolutionaries in the 60s and 70s against the Shah, they kind of cut their teeth as revolutionaries on the Palestinian issue. This is something that they feel very deeply about, both politically and religiously. In that sense, I'm not sure if there's a distinction between the two. But this goes back to the issue of justice, what we were talking about mm-hmm. earlier. And for them, you know, the ultimate injustice, if you were to line up all of them and say, you know, what is the ultimate injustice? All of them unequivocally would say, you know, the creation of Israel and the treatment of the Palestinians. That being said, I think that, you know, it's useful to kind of put into context Ayatollah Khamenei's position toward Israel. Because I have a passage here, and I have a section on his thoughts toward Israel. And, you know, from his vantage point, he thinks he's being actually quite magnanimous, because he says, you know, Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was the Egyptian pan-Arab leader, he called for the Jews to go swim in the sea, essentially. And Saddam Hussein used to say that he's going to light half of Palestine on fire. And he said, no, our positions are not that. We're not advocating genocide. We're essentially advocating that every person who lives in that area, the Holy Land, be granted a vote, whether you're Jewish, Muslim, or Christian. And the result of that vote should determine the future of whatever state that is, you know, with the obvious notion being that Palestinians now constitute the demographic majority there. Mm-hmm. And the state of Israel would essentially be referendum out of existence. It would be, you know, it's a very crude way of saying we want a one-state solution. That being said, I think for him, he believes that as a preface to this referendum, he advocates armed struggle. And he says that, you know, the quote-unquote, the Zionists have never given up an inch of land based on negotiations. And this is why we see Iran supporting these militant groups opposed to Israel, Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad. And, you know, their calculations are that, you know, they've gained more by supporting these groups than they have negotiations, which, you know, I think is a position you could argue with.
You'd think that if they really were pro-Palestinian, that rather than support Hamas and Hezbollah, that they would rather support them economically, but then I guess, as you say, then they would have fewer people to attack Israel. But that seems would see. This is true not only of Iran, but a lot of the Arab states as well. One wonders why they don't pour all their billions of oil money into Palestine to help them economically instead of letting them.
And I suppose they would argue that they do also provide services. You know, in Lebanon, they've created hospitals for the Shiite community. After Lebanon, much of South Lebanon was destroyed by, you know, Israeli bombs in the summer of 2006. They actually played a far more prominent role in the rebuilding of southern Lebanon than probably anyone else. So they would argue that in addition to, actually they wouldn't acknowledge that they actually armed these groups. They would say, no, we've just provide moral support. But they would say that, you know, no, we also provide social services, et cetera. And again, this goes back to the issue of justice, this notion that, you know, they want the perception to be that we're we're the champions of the downtrodden. We're, you know, Che Guevara, and we're looking up for the downtrodden. And I think the irony in all of this is that that's again why they want to keep these individuals downtrodden, because they can only be their champions.
I'm going to ask you one more question, and then I'm going to open this up to questions. You talk about Khamenei, and it seems to me that he is that he could go both ways on the whole issue of the United States and his position on the United States. And it's not clear whether he thinks that whether he is against the United States or whether he believes the United States is against him.
Mm.
There does seem to be a lot of paranoia in there, but
yeah.
He has left the door open to a new administration. Clearly there's a lot of anti-Bush feeling there. But he has left the door open by saying, you know, that our feeling about the United States could change. I mean, you have a passage in there, I don't know the
yeah.
exact words of it, but we're, you know, this isn't always going to be the situation with us. Do you think, for instance, that if McCain or Obama were elected, mm. particularly if Obama were elected, that would change, and Obama's call for dialogue and reaching out, would that make a huge difference in
yeah.
our relationship with Iran?
It's a great question. And you know, one of the things I found after doing this study was that Khamenei is not an idiot. And you know, and because you know, one of the things that idiots like myself have been advocating the last many years is that if you engage Iran, you open Iran up to the world. There's foreign investment. You know, there's an embassy in Tehran. All of these things, you're really going to expedite political reform within Iran. And Khamenei, again, is not an idiot. He understands that argument quite well. And for that reason, I think he has great ambivalence about mending this relationship with the United States, I think much along the same lines as Fidel Castro in Cuba, that you know, he realizes it's much easier to retain the status quo in Iran, the Islamic Republic status quo, in isolation. And the day when you do have kind of a U.S. embassy in Tehran, you have you know, foreign companies in Tehran and foreign tourists and all of these things, it's going to really dilute the Islamicness of the Islamic Republic. I think this is something that he very much fears. So I was thinking about this, that if you're a hardliner in Tehran, does it present more of a quandary for you to have a U.S. president who says, let's talk, let's be friends? Or does it present more of a quandary for you to have a U.S. president who says, let's continue to be adversaries? I think it's the former. I think that if you're a hardliner in Tehran, someone like Senator Obama actually presents much more of a quandary for you. Because, you know, this is all this revolution, this was one of the pillars of this revolution, of the Islamic Republic, the creation of the Islamic Republic, this anti-Americanism. And if you get rid of that, I think they're very concerned that, you know, then what are then the foundations that this revolution has to stand on? So what I would say is that I think that when you talk to, I was based in Tehran for a number of years, and when you talk to kind of Iranian political elite in private, the vast majority, I'm talking, you know, upwards of 90% in my own estimation, really understand that this death to America culture that was created in 1979 is really obsolete in 2008. And they would very much like to make amends and to have a friendly relationship with the United States, and are positively disposed towards the United States. But you have a small but very powerful minority in the country of these hardliners who I think understand that their power and their wealth derives in part from their isolation. I mean, think about it like this. If you're a 75-year-old cleric, and your only education was in the seminaries of Qom 55 years ago, and you have a very senior post in the Iranian government, do you really want Iran to open up to the world and become more meritocratic? I don't think so. I think you see that as a threat to your own power. Or if you're a Revolutionary Guardsman with, you know, a high school education, who right now is privy to billion-dollar oil deals because the Shells and the Totals and the Conocos and the Chevrons are not doing any business in Iran, do you really want Iran to open up its economy and join the WTO? I don't think you do. I think you see that as a threat to your interests. So, you know, what's happened over the last 2-3 decades is that whenever there's been opportunities of kind of a confidence being built between the U.S. and Iran or dialogue taking place, you will see these radicals in Tehran doing something to sabotage this effort and torpedo this effort. And I think the problem is that the U.S. always seems to respond to those saboteurs, and then the whole thing, you know, deteriorates. But, you know, where does Ayatollah Khamenei fit into this? I my own cynical interpretation is that he kind of fits in the latter camp, that he somehow believes that the revolution and the Islamic Republic needs this adversarial relationship with the United States. And that's why I think we should not give it to him. We should not, you know, offer it to him on a silver platter.
Okay. Why don't we open the open to questions?
Yes.
Sorry, I have a problem with my voice today. Yeah. Nadia Bilbesi with NBC TV. I just want to ask you about something you haven't talked about, which is Iran's relationship vis-a-vis the neighbors across the Arabian Gulf or the Persian Gulf. You know, there seems to be some kind of competition between, especially Saudi Arabia and Iran. There is kind of perception, there is fear from the Gulf states towards Iran. But yet there is active diplomacy. You have seen Ahmadinejad being invited to Mecca to perform the pilgrimage, etc. How do you read this relationship? And do you see it put in the same category as the West vis-a-vis Iran, or is it a special relationship between the Arab states and Iran?
Should we start? Yeah. It's a great question, Nadia. You know, let me recount another interesting anecdote there was several years back, there was a Clinton administration, a former Clinton administration senior official who was visiting Tehran. He was giving a talk at the Iranian Foreign Ministry's graduate school. And he was saying that he had been traveling, before he came to Tehran, he had been traveling around the Gulf, the Persian Gulf. And he said that the Gulf countries are extremely worried about Iran's nuclear ambitions. And, you know, this is the number one source of insecurity, et cetera. And he began taking the second. Before he could finish what he was going to say, there was an Iranian official there. And he said, you know, what are you talking about? And he pulled out the latest poll from, I think, the Pew Foundation, which had asked Arabs, and I think even Gulf Arabs, what do you fear most? What's the primary source of insecurity in the Middle East? And all of them obviously said Israel and the United States. And Iran was very low on the list. In fact, the majority of them were supportive of Iran's nuclear ambitions. What I'm trying to say is that I think there's a discrepancy between the leaders of these countries who are extremely worried about Iran and Iran's ambitions, and their populations, who I think, you know, are less so. But, you know, in terms of kind of Iran and Saudi Arabia in particular, I think you have, you know, two main kind of venues for this rivalry right now playing out. One is obviously Iraq, and the other is Lebanon. And the Saudis are extremely concerned about Iran's ambitions. And what's interesting from the Iranian perspective is that whereas I think the Saudis view this much more of a Sunni Shiite issue, this is actually now not how the Iranians want this to be framed. You know, oftentimes you will hear that Iran is trying to foment sectarian unrest in Iraq or in Lebanon, and this is actually precisely the opposite of what Iran wants. You know, think about it. If you're Iran and you want to be the vanguard of the entire Middle East, and you want to be, you know, the regional power, you want to see sectarian tension. You don't. I mean, Shiites constitute 10% of the region's Muslims. The last thing they want to do is project Shiite power. They want to kind of project pan-Islamic power. So the Iranians are very worried about this, sectarian issue enlarging. And I think they've been trying to take steps to kind of allay the concerns of these Gulf countries. And I think, You know, I do sympathize with these Gulf countries because, on one hand, they're very concerned about, you know, they don't want to see Iran get the bomb, and they don't want to see Iran get bombed. And it's this, this dilemma that they've been having. And, you know, what's funny is that I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to. I speak to U.S. officials who say, we just got back from the Gulf, and they say, and they told us they totally support us, our U.S.'s hardline approach toward Iran. And then you talk to an Iranian official who says, I just got back from the Gulf, they totally support our nuclear ambitions. So they essentially tell both sides what they want to hear because, you know, they don't have the luxury of not being Iran's neighbors. So they have to, you know, put on a friendly face towards them. But at the same time, they're very, very worried about
Iran. You know, I the one question that I meant to ask you that we didn't get to is, does Iran want the United States out of Iraq or not?
I think in the near term, the status quo works perfectly for Iran and Iraq. Why? Because they have their friends, their chief allies, the Shiite co-religious in a position of power, and they have their main adversary, the United States, bleeding very heavily. So I think in the short term, the status quo works out quite well for them. But, you know, I don't think that despite all their calls for a U.S. withdrawal, I'm not sure if they really want an abrupt U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. And this idea that somehow Iran could fill the vacuum left behind by the United States or Iran could dominate the country, I think, is entirely false. And it's a real misreading of Iraqi Shiites. I mean, this I did a report about this, about Iran's role in Iraq several years ago when I was with the International Crisis Group. And one thing we found very interesting was that even amongst the Shiites, or maybe you could even say especially among the Shiite community in Iraq, there was tremendous skepticism of Iran's role in Iraq. And you know, you have to remember that Iraqi Shiites fought Iranian Shiites for 8 years during the Iran-Iraq War. And a lot of these Iraqi Shiites who had spent time in Iran during Saddam's era, they were refugees or you know, they were being politically supported by Tehran, they didn't have a great experience in Iran. They felt discriminated against. And so I think that Iran is even probably cognizant of the fact that, you know, were there to be an abrupt U.S. withdrawal, it would not be in their interest. The last thing Iran wants to see is kind of a failed state or a civil war in Iraq. There was a civil war in Afghanistan for a couple of decades, which produced an influx of 2 million Afghan refugees in Iran. So the last thing Iran wants to see is kind of Iraq break down into an al-Qaeda infested failed state.
I guess, oh gosh, yes.
There was a recent resolution in Congress, kind of a lot of people called it the blockade resolution, sort of ostensibly preventing the import of petroleum products into Iran. Florida recently passed a resolution making it difficult for Iranian American travel agencies to send people to people-to-people contact, and this seems to contradict the Bush administration's stated objective of increasing these people-to-people contacts. And so some of these sanctions kind of criminalize that element. So what kind of things is the United States doing and should it be doing to lift the barriers to communication that you claim is a sort of vehicle for democratization?
Yeah, that's a very good question, too. And one example I like to give is when I used to be based in Tehran, there was a guy I used to go interview from time to time who was a former deputy foreign minister whose uncle was a grand ayatollah, basically, you know, quintessential regime insider. And he was always like the most difficult guy I had to interview. He was, you know, he always, you know, suspected I was working with the CIA and very suspicious of me and very kind of harsh and anti-American. And a couple of years ago, 2.5 years ago, he somehow got a fellowship to be a fellow at Harvard, at the Belfer Center, Security Studies Fellow. I said, this is crazy. You know, of all the people they could invite from Iran, they invite this guy? You know, why on earth are they doing that? And I was very upset by this. And, you know, what happened was very interesting, that he came to Boston for, you know, 6 to 8 months. And some of his colleagues were telling me this as well. Initially, he came, you know, very defiant and putting up. But you know, over time he had this very interesting kind of interaction with his colleagues at Harvard who were working on this Iranian nuclear issue. And, you know, basically what happens is communication and dialogue, and they began to kind of understand some of Iran's concerns a bit more. And he began to really understand the image which Iran was projecting to the world. And over the course of the 6 to 8 months that he was here, he wrote two fantastic op-ed pieces. One was in the Financial Times. I think both were actually in the Financial Times, the Herald Tribune, which I actually refer to a lot in some of my own work. And it was very, you know, sober pieces calling for you know, Iran making certain compromises, etc. The point I'm trying to make is that I've never seen in all of, you know, whenever there's interaction, I've never seen negative repercussions of it. That, you know, whenever you bring the Iranians here, you expose them to what's going on. I know you have Americans going to Iran. The outcome, I've always seen it, is unequivocally positive, the outcome of some type of a dialogue. So people-to-people contacts, I think, are very important. And I think this, I saw this law being passed, or it's being contemplated in the Florida legislature, which would, I think, fine travel agencies to sell tickets to Iran is totally asinine. But I think this is a dilemma, right, which the U.S. government has, European governments have. And the dilemma is this, is that when Iran had a president, Mohammad Khatami, right, the reform-minded president who was talking about dialogue of civilizations, etc., what did they get in return? You know, the perception from Tehran is that they were placed into the axis of evil, and, you know, they projected a weak image when they were talking about dialogue of civilizations. And the dilemma the Europeans especially, and, you know, the Americans to an extent have, is that how do you now offer incentives to Iran or overtures to Iran which weren't on the table, which you didn't offer during the Khatami era? What is the signal that you're sending to Ayatollah Khamenei? That when you talk about dialogue of civilizations, you project weakness and you get placed in the axis of evil. But if you deny the Holocaust and you call for Israel to wipe off the map, we'll offer you overtures and incentives which we didn't offer you before. So this is a big dilemma, I know, especially from the Europeans, that they say, yeah, we understand that this approach toward Iran needs to be mended. And I think, you know, deep down in the heart of many kind of even senior Bush administrations, they say, we understand this policy needs to be mended, but the timing is important. And we don't want to do anything that's going to kind of validate or rehabilitate President Ahmadinejad's approach.
Well, I see a lot of hands, and we're over 10 o'clock. What do you think? Two more questions? Okay.
Alessandro Cocco from U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. My question regards religious charities. We know that religious charities and religious foundations in Iran play a very important role. You mentioned all revenues, etc., so we know where their resources come from, but we don't know where money go. Given the fact that Iran, apart from Tehran, I might be wrong, but has no excellent welfare system, welfare state, no infrastructures, no excellent healthcare system or educational system. My question is, do you know where money go, where the resources are invested? Because we have two alternatives. The first is personal treasures, but it looks like religious leaders in Iran live in a very sober way. So the other alternative is they are invested abroad. So don't you think that working on investments coming from religious charities could be a good way to solve problems or a good starting point more than another war? Thank you very much.
Want to take another question? Mm-hmm. I'll combine them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm Leonard Oberlander, a consultant, and you had mentioned earlier Seymour Hersh's article in The New Yorker exposing the covert operations in Iran in connection with the missile launches. So apparently this is a something significant in this article. My question is, what is your viewpoint of this along three dimensions. One, conveying legitimacy to the Iranian regime, as you had also mentioned earlier. Two, the moral courage, the morality of this exposing, and also the dimension of civic duty or good citizenship. It's something to wrestle with, and I imagine there would be different viewpoints on this. How do you see this?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the first question about religious charities, and you ended by saying, shouldn't we focus on these rather than start the war? And, you know, I want to make it clear, I'm unequivocally opposed to any type of military action. But, you know, Iran's finances are unbelievably nebulous. It's incredibly nebulous. So there's no way to tell, you know, where this money is going. These religious charities, they're called bonyas, they're essentially a black hole. You know, some accounts, 10% of Iran's GDP goes to these religious foundations, and no one really knows how the money is spent. But there is some, I mean, indication that, we do know that Iran spends approximately $20 billion a year on subsidies. So this is why it's cheaper to buy gasoline than it is water. This is why bread is very cheap. And you really don't see, poverty in Iran the way you do see it in Latin America and India, and nor should you, by the way. I mean, this is has tremendous natural resources. So, you know, basically the finances are incredibly nebulous, and, you know, I think the dilemma is that I think in the short term, maybe the signal Bush administration officials and European officials want to send to Tehran is that belligerence is not going to reap your rewards. So if you want to be belligerent and non-compromising, we're going to punish you with economic sanctions, etc. Those are the short-term tactics. But really, the long-term strategy should be to open Iran up to the world economy and to open Iran up to the world. So kind of the short-term tactics and the long-term strategy are at loggerheads, because in the short term, we have to send stern signals to them, and we do it economically. But over the longer term, we should open the country up economically. So I think this is a dilemma. Now, on Cy Hirsch's piece, are you asking me about Cy Hirsch himself?
No, about how this places American-Iranian relations, socio-politically, socio-religiously, in perspective. If you look at these dimensions, from high to low, is it helping relations? Is it helping relations along the dimension of legitimacy for the Iranian regime? Is it something that should have been published at the time it was? Well, not that it should have. What is the effect of publishing it on the issue of morality and of good citizenship? Is it going to divide people?
I think that the article by Cy Hirsch, whom I love, I played tennis with Cy Hirsch's piece in The New Yorker, he essentially argues that there's a covert operation taking place, and the United States has spent, you know, or spending $400 million to kind of foment ethnic unrest within Iran. You know, despite the fact that the word Persian and Iranian is used interchangeably, actually only about 50% of Iranians are Persian, and you have Azeri Turks and Kurds and Baluchis. And what Cy Hirsch essentially is arguing is the U.S. government is supporting these ethnic groups to cause a problem for the central government in Tehran. And it's not oftentimes I can use the word unequivocally. I use it vis-a-vis military action. I'll use it now that I think this is unequivocally an awful policy, if indeed it's happening, to kind of try to tear the country apart. And the reason why is that, you know, Iran is not a post-Ottoman entity which was drawn in a cocktail napkin by Winston Churchill. You know, Iran is a country with 2,000 years of history as a nation state. And whether you're Kurd, Baluchi, Persian, etc., there's a strong attachment to the soil of Iran. And if our goal, if the United States' goal, is to try to bring about kind of a more democratic, nationalist Iran, you're going to really alienate those Democrats that you're hoping to come to power one day if they see that you're trying to tear the country apart. So if indeed that is happening, I think it's an awful policy.
I think that's it. Karim? Sajapur, thank you so much.
Thank you.